This seminar by Doug Gold, titled In-Ear Monitors, is made available to you through Sovereign Grace Ministries. It was recorded at our Worship God 2008 conference. Doug is a U.S. Market Development Manager for Shure Incorporated.
So we're going to talk about how to lower stage volumes a little bit here. That's my information. I can't teach everything there is to know about in-ear monitoring in an hour and 15 minutes. So you have a book. You can read that tonight. There's actually two books on the subject. And they're educational books. They're not sales brochures. We don't really talk about our models so much. It's more generic applicational stuff. It's very, very neutral. I'm available by phone when I'm home. I'm only gone about half the year. So you can email me if you can't reach me by phone and ask me any questions that might come up. Even during the class, if they come up, we'll answer them now. You don't have to email me. So, some of you here are worship leaders, okay, and sound people, okay, a bit more than worship leaders. Why are the worship leaders here? You want to just find out more about?
Sometimes we're the sound people.
Okay, like I am, yeah. So you have worship leader and sound guys. How many do that? Okay. So the sound guys are probably here because they want to figure out how to end this volume that they're getting off the stage. We demonstrated that pretty effectively yesterday by turning off the monitors so you could just hear what the main sound like with nothing going on the stage. And it is a drastic difference than when you have to compete with another PA system that's on the stage facing the wrong way and reflecting off back walls. It's just hard to get any kind of a clean mix if that's going on. And the smaller your space, the more evident and obvious that problem is going to be. You can get away with it in much larger spaces if there's some absorption on the stage. But suffice it to say that I think in-ear monitor is probably the single best solution you can look at for solving that problem, especially in a small to mid-sized church. So our ministry is leading people into worship, communion with God, playing excellently, serving God, maintaining unity in the body of Christ. Christ didn't die for the perfect worship service. I don't know if you know that, or the great mix. He died to give us life, and he wants to see people's lives changed. And we're ministers first, before we're sound geeks or great guitar players. So that's the call. And we're playing to the seats, as Patty... what's her last name? I forget. Who's the... Sandy Patty. She's a tenor sound man. We play to the seats. That's who we play for. Your seats are the congregation. That's who we play for. To see if they're going to get changed. Faith comes by hearing. Nobody can hear the word. Nobody gets changed. It's a pretty simple ministry. So what gets in the way of it? Excess stage volumes. Excess front of house volumes, unfocused muddy sound, stress between the worship team, tech team, and ministry staff. That stress is obvious, visuals. If you want to just look at something sometime, take a videotape in 10 minutes before the service starts and everybody's stressed out running around. And just videotape all that chaos going on and that's transported to the platform. And there's this whole spirit of chaos and disunity in many of our churches today. And I try to get a lot of that stuff taken care of during the week and pray before service instead of trying to do everything 10, 15 minutes before the service starts. So I didn't think you were going to get much team building on this today, but I think it's important to stress it. Hearing damage. I see infants 3 months, 4 months old in churches that are 110 dB plus and wondering why people continue to keep their little babies in those kind of environments. I played in a rock band until I was 30, and I've got severe hearing loss in the upper frequencies because of it. But it's not just the volume at a spike. It's a certain volume over duration of time. They did a study of the Chicago Symphony with the violin section, and they found that 40% of the violinists had lost about 60% of their hearing in their left ear where the violin is. So they're not playing it loudly, but they're playing 8 hours a day in practice, and it's going to do some damage. So if you're playing 5-6 services a week at loud levels, be aware of what can happen. If you lose your hearing as a musician or engineer, you're going to have to start teaching Sunday school or deaf ministry, either one. Ask three people what the problem is. You get three different answers. Musicians will say, I can't hear myself, unless, you know, you're in a different kind of a church than I am. The techs just don't understand my sensitive artistic needs. I'm really stressed out right now. Get with the program. Okay, that's one group. Here's another group, the tech team. Musicians are too loud. Musicians keep interrupting me all the time. You think you got stress? Sit in my seat for a Sunday. And then there's the third group, the congregation. Why is it so stinking loud? But I can't hear the words. And why am I feeling stressed out? Got all these things going on. And a lot of it arises just basically from the volume issues. Or the unintelligibility of the sound, is another way of putting it. It might be louder, but it's also very unintelligible, not articulate. Okay. Volume and sanctuary, talking about this. Size and materials affect how things are going to sound. We found that yesterday in the big gym. Big, big room, but reflective as anything. You got perpendicular walls. Front of house speakers are firing off the back. And a couple of milliseconds later, you're hearing that wash come back to the stage. Standing waves between the two sidewalls. This bass buildup. You got the monitors firing off another reflective wall here. So it's just a big reflective box. So, in these kind of situations where you have reflections, I'm going to show you that in-ear monitors are going to be a very big help, at least for the musician's standpoint, of being able to hear in time. When you hear the drum beat, you'll hear the drum beat. It won't be a reflection off a back wall 3 milliseconds later. I was just telling somebody at my booth, I had a friend sing at Yankee Stadium, had to sing the national anthem. I recommended to him that he would bring in-ear monitors. He said, oh, no, I'll be fine. I said, have you ever sang in a stadium like that before? He goes, no, but it shouldn't be any big deal. Said, okay. Glad it's not on TV. Right? So he's singing, oh, say, can you see? By the time he got to see, he started hearing, oh, say, can you see? It totally messed him up. He couldn't sing the rest of the song. I never seen anybody booed off the stage for not being able to sing the national anthem. But if he had in-ear monitors, he wouldn't have heard any of those reflections. So this has a lot to do with what you can do with wedges in the first place. You got a big room like this. You know, you can space the wedges out, and if this is absorbing, it's going to help. You notice that this isn't perpendicular anywhere. So in those bigger spaces, you can get away with wedges all day long. But how many of our churches in America are like that? Typical church's average size is 75 to 100 people. Worship team's on a 10 by 10 platform. Some are meeting in little Holiday Inn conference rooms like we are. You know, so the smaller the space, the more sound is going to saturate in that space. Especially in the room we were like in yesterday. Okay, so you get the point of that, right? Any questions on that? This is the fastest growing audio trend right now because, as I said in the beginning of the class, it's probably the single most effective solution to reducing those kind of issues. Now, let's talk about some things you can do before you go to in-ear monitors. We talked about some of them yesterday. You can move things around so they don't reflect off walls, if possible. You can buy the right kind of floor monitors, ones that instead of projecting horizontally, get some that project vertically. You can isolate things. If you have an extra room, put the guitar amp and the bass cabinet in an ISO room and take that feed and bring it back into the house. Now, if you're going to do that, obviously the guitar player is going to need some earphones to hear his amplifier mic'd up from a distance. But there's a lot of solutions you can do before you just go out and buy a whole in-ear system. You can get the musicians to play lower. Now, one way to do that, we talked about this yesterday. I don't know if any of you are doing this, but mix your house sound first. do your mains first. Don't do your monitors first. Why would I say that? Right. If you do the monitors first, that's going to set the bar for how loud everything is. And musicians are so used to hearing everything from their monitors that they're not getting any of the energy, or the thing that makes a musician want to play better is that ambient rush of sound, which is usually in the mid, low bass, and in that range. That's what really gives them the energy, right? So you get them to play without monitors for a few songs. Say, look, just bear with me here. So you play with just the mains with no monitors. And after maybe two or three songs, they're starting to feel the energy, even though it's a very weird paradigm shift for them to be playing that way. They'll start getting a feel for the room. Once they start getting a feel for that energy in the room, if it's not a completely dead room, this should work. Then they're going to start asking you for a lot less in their monitor. You say, oh, I just need maybe a little more hi-hat. I need some articulation in that vocal. Bring that vocal up a little bit. Maybe a little acoustic guitar. But it's usually those kind of things that aren't in that lower range. Then as Dave pointed out yesterday, the next you can do is you can roll off all that stuff in the monitors as well because you're getting it from the room. The thing that really is bad about monitors is the way that they leak low-frequency sound into the front of the church. Because I don't know if you know this, but bass frequencies are omnidirectional. So even though the monitor might be facing this way, and high frequencies are very localized, but bass frequencies aren't. They'll lobe over the back of the monitor and spread into the front of the house, which really mixes up and muddies up the front of house sound. So if they can get used to the energy from the room, now you can lower all those frequencies, those bass frequencies, those low bass, mid bass frequencies in their monitor and give them a cleaner detail. So I would challenge you to try that. And you might find just that in itself is going to help to lower a lot of the stage volumes without having to go out and buy six or seven new in-ear systems. Right? Is it worth a try? How many people have not been doing it that way? Raise your hands. Okay? So try it. We got the musicians so used to hearing everything through their monitors, they're not even hearing the room. The Beatles played Shea Stadium with no monitors. They couldn't hear themselves, but it was 18,000 screaming teenagers. But that's where we got the idea of foldback. It turned speakers back so now the band could hear themselves. I played in bars till I was 30. A lot of times we didn't have monitors. The stages were too small. So you had to get the energy of the band by listening to each other in the room. And that's what happens. So you reinforce the vocals, and that's about it. Everybody have any questions on that, or...?
If you're dependent on the house mix as a musician on stage, what happens then when the congregation arrives and all of a sudden that is covered up by that and you're dependent on that?
Well, regardless of whether you start monitors or mains first, it's going to change when people fill up the room. You've got to make adjustments for that. And you want to comment on that, Dave?
Well, I would say some of it will fill up. I think a lot of the slapback you'll hear energy-wise will definitely increase, which is probably more of a good thing. But again, you got speakers, your mains up here, that, like he was saying, all that low frequency is coming right off the back of the speakers. So you got a direct line of the speaker right over your head. That's not going to affect too much. It'll dampen it a little bit because it won't have a delayed wash come back. So that, and that, you know, allows you to still keep the monitor a little off, you know, on stage. You're still using the monitors, but you're only using the high frequencies of the monitors, or more of the high frequencies, rather than the full low frequency energy. The one thing that we always talk about too is this. One of the reasons we always say start with the house first too is because if you EQ the monitors the way we're talking about and you start with the monitors, everything goes, this stinks. Oh my goodness, I can't stand the way this sounds. Because they have no low end because you roll it all off without the monitors. But if you start with the actual front of house, they get all that warm, and then now all of a sudden you bring up this high from the monitors, you're like, yeah.
Right.
Awesome. And if they need a little bit more, you can turn it up. And those high frequencies will just cut right through them, and they'll be like, that's exactly what I need. And you won't have to turn all that low frequency energy up, which is muddying up your front house mix more. give that directional sound, which is directional because of the...
I have some slides here, and you'll be able to see that some of that demonstrated as we go along here. So, you know, initially the church started with something like this, a piano or a pipe organ. We had a choir. And as things progressed, you know, then we added the drum set and the bass, the guitar, monitors. Okay. This is the same space that was designed for traditional worship. It's now being used for loud, contemporary rock and roll church. Problem with wedges and sound sources on the stage is, again, it's all interfering with each other. There's competing PA systems here. So this is the traditional approach, a floor monitor. And we're probably still using many of those. Even if you start using in-ear monitors, does that mean I have to get rid of all my floor monitors? No, but the more that you get rid of, the cleaner the sound's going to be. That's all. There's lots of churches that are using both. Some old guys like me can't get used to an in-ear monitor. Still have to have a wedge. But I got the right kind of wedge, one that aims up at me. It doesn't have to be 6 feet away for it to be in a sweet spot. And I only need certain things in it. Spot monitors. Pros and cons to those. Yep.
Earlier when you said using floor monitors that aim up at you, you meant like diagonally towards the other, not
yeah.
Vertical.
Yeah, there's a floor monitor. Typically a floor monitor will have like two cuts on it.
Right.
So there's one that will be a little bit more vertical and one that will be a little bit more horizontal.
Okay.
But they never really get that vertical. A lot of the new monitors coming out, I think Community and some other ones, have almost rounded monitors. You sit on the floor and you get right on top of them. And you're that close to the sound, which means, as we learn here in a couple minutes, I don't have to turn the amp up as loud to get them to my ears. If I have to stand 12 feet back, I got to turn that amp up significantly to get the same gain out of it. And now it's washing all over the stage. See? Dave, you can chime in any time here. Everybody know what comb filtering is? Any idea? Comb filtering happens a lot of times with microphones when, let's say you have a choir and you have a microphone on one section and then you have another microphone that's too close. So now you have one source that's being picked up by this microphone. Let's say however far that is, 3 feet. So 3 milliseconds it takes to get this one. And if this one is like 2 feet farther away, the same sound source takes an extra 2 or 3 milliseconds to get here. So now you have the same exact sound that started at different times. It's going to the mixer, it's summed, and when they come together, you get this effect called comb filtering. Because the graph looks like a comb. Certain frequencies are boosted, certain ones are cut. It's not a smooth line anymore. And you've all heard it. If a pastor's wearing a lavalier or a headworn, and he goes in front of his pulpit, and there's another mic on, now there's two mics on the same voice, and something just happened to the sound. It sounds hollow, it sounds distant, doesn't sound natural. That also happens with loudspeakers. When they start interfering with each other, you get different things happen at different times, and you add the reflections in, and before you know it, things are completely out of sync and out of phase. So that's what comb filtering is. You can even get comb filtering with one microphone. You have a podium mic, plexiglass podium, pastor's speaking into it and into the mic. So the mic gets direct sound, then the reflected sound goes into the microphone a millisecond or two later. The only way to prevent that with one mic is to put a blotter or use some other kind of surface for that microphone or get the microphone closer to his voice. So comb filtering sounds bad.
Is there a rule of thumb as far as microphones distance?
Yeah, 3-to-1 rule it's called. So whatever the distance is from the mic to the source, the next open mic should be 3 times this distance. And it's not just some number they picked out of the air. Why does that work? It has to do with the inverse square law. And anybody know what the inverse square law is? Want to be bored some more? It applies to astronomy and light. If you had a lighting fixture and you wanted to get certain intensity of light on a stage, okay? Say you get X intensity, all right? Well, if I double the distance away, I'm going to lose 4 times the intensity. I'll get a bigger wash, but it won't be as intense. Same thing with audio. If I have a monitor here and I get a certain level of sound pressure, let's say that's 90 dB, and I move back half the distance or twice the distance, I go from 3 to 6 feet, I've lost 6 dB, which is roughly 4 times less power. It'd be like going from 800 watts, just doubling the distance, to 200 watts. If I double the distance again, it'd be like going from 3,200 watts to 200 watts, just because of distance and intensity. So when you're placing microphones on your talent, try to get them consistent at a distance, because it's going to help your mix keep consistent. Same thing with your speakers. If you want to turn things down, you got to get the speakers closer to the people or closer to the talent. That's just physics. I'll use Dave's line. It's God's law, not mine. If you want to break the laws of physics, you're in sin. Right? He's the one who made the laws. Take it up with him. I feel like Elijah over here. Open air monitors seriously mess with front of house sound. That's why I don't like them. And in most churches, it's not just the monitors, it's everything else that's going on at the same time. The bass cabinet, the guitar amp, the acoustics of the drums. They're not shielded, they're not isolated. The reflections of the room, it's a small room. So.
Yeah, I was going to say, yesterday, this is kind of interesting. We had the band play a little bit in the main gymatorium over there.
Oops, sorry.
And,
That's fine.
Yesterday, we were having a band play a little bit in the gymatorium over there, and the interesting thing was everybody heard that the drums were really stinking loud still, but they're only half as loud as they were the night before because they had the drums actually out on stage a little bit more. We had them back behind a curtain a little bit that was absorbing a lot of stuff. When they're out in that actual room, I mean, they were twice as loud as that, and that's just, that's a big culprit for a lot of things.
I think this will demonstrate what I'm talking about with the closest of the monitor. If you see this, if he's too close to a horizontal throwing monitor, where's the sound going? Right off the back wall. That's no good. So he's got to be that far away from it to be in the sweet spot. Now I got to turn up. Now, anytime you monitor with anything, you've got to be about 10 dB louder than the ambient noise. An example that I can use that everybody's familiar with, you're in a noisy place and your wife calls you on your cell phone. What do you do with your other ear? You plug it up so you can hear it. Otherwise, that phone would have to be 10 dB louder than that sound around you. And usually it's not. It's usually at the same level. So you need a difference of 10 dB. So I'm using a wedge on the stage and I got all this sound going on, guitar amps and drums. That's going to set a certain level even without the monitors being on, right? So my monitor has to be 10 dB louder than whatever this is. So if the stage is 90, my floor monitor has got to be about 100. Are you with me? So here's a stage volume. Here's a front of house volume. It's got to be 10 dB louder than the stage volume. So I increase this up, 10 dB. Now this has got to go up. And this goes up, and this has got to go up. You 10 dB more, you can guess where this is headed. That's Ted Nugent levels right there.
Yeah.
It seems like a lot of the sound cabinets and the speakers are more directional than they were just 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So I feel like we're having better success with some new speakers we've got in because there's not as much.
You sell them.
Particularly the high frequency. They're not coming back on the stage, so my stage is a lot quieter than it used to be on the house.
I agree with that. And there's also cabinets that you can get now, the ISO cabinets, that have a speaker in an airtight enclosure with a mic built in. And you can run your guitar amp right into that.
Actually, it may not be on.
When your guitar cabinet right into that, and it's a direct feed right to the house, and you get this great, great speaker sound with no energy emitted on the stage.
I think you probably can record it.
nonetheless, I mean, if you can't put it into a room and you can't get an ISO box, there's some other things you can do to quiet the guitar amp down, which is next time you move, just take one of those U-Haul blankets home with you and throw it over the guitar amp and put a mic under it. That really dampens the sound a lot. It's used, that technique is used a lot in recording studios. You can use recording studio techniques. It might look kind of weird to have gobos. Everyone know what a gobo is? It's like a 2x4 frame with acoustic material in it with fabric on the outside of it. In a recording studio, when you get a bunch of musicians playing together, they usually put gobos between like the guitar amp and the drums and the bass cabinet, things like that, to help isolate and calm down the energy. But it might kind of look weird unless you put like Praise the Lord flags on them or something, you know. Right, right. They don't know. It hasn't been there for years. Just a big box that you put under the cabinet one day. Right. So you got, we talked about the volume wear from front of house to monitor. There's also the volume wear that's going on between the musicians. So this, you know, you'll catch this. Perhaps the drummer went to Starbucks on his way to church. Begins playing a little faster and louder. And the lead vocalist turns up to hear over the drummer. It's the age-old problem. You know, more me. I must increase. That's not what it says, right? So, if you're not already deaf, you'll get uncomfortable at volume levels above 95 dB. I've heard rocking mixes at 85 dB if they've had the right energy and the right EQ applied to them. I've heard mixes at 100, 110. They'll just kill you, hurt you. There's no reason for it to be that loud. So in the part two of the mixing class today, I'm going to play a couple of mixes that are heavy in certain frequencies, and they're all the same level. And you'll hear how one sounds just like, ouch. And it's the same level as another mix, which is clean. So I don't know what kind of levels you guys are getting in your churches. I don't know if they're this loud or not. But after a while, the ears are going to have their own compression kick in. It's called threshold shift. No matter how much louder you play it, it's going to be like a limiter at that point. It's just going to stop. So, and that's when the damage can start. So I talked about this before. You need a difference of 10 dB. Whether it's a floor monitor or whether it's an ear monitor. The beautiful thing about ear monitors is this. To take that same stage, it was 90 dB. When I put an in-ear isolating earphone in, I'm now isolated from the ambient noise. It's 90 dB. Any generic universal earphone that isolates. I'm not talking about the buds that come with your iPod that just sit here. I'm talking about things that actually go in the ear canal. When you use those properly, you're going to isolate minimum 15 to 20 dB below the stage level. So now the band is 90 dB on the stage. I'm starting with a noise floor of 70 dB. And I only need to monitor 10 dB above that level. So I'm monitoring at 10 dB, at 80 dB less than the stage volume is. That's the whole point of it. So when you see people pulling out, that's a no-no. You just disrupted the whole usefulness of an in-ear monitor because now all that volume has got to go in this ear at 10 dB louder than the stage because the stage volume is going in this ear. So you just crank this one up to an abnormally high level, damaging this ear that's got the earphone in it because you got to hear over that. It's a cell phone example again. I got to plug this ear up so I can hear my wife with the grocery list. That makes sense to everybody? So you got to keep them in. Yeah.
The problem is for most of the musicians, and you know this because you have to play through a wedge,
right,
is you don't get any of the congregation,
right,
unless you mic them.
Right. And we're gonna cover that ambient mic. That because I'm going to give you some strengths of in-ear monitors. I'm also going to give you some weaknesses of them and some things that you have to work around. And there's definitely some things you have to work around. We can try electronic drums. He's just got a Roland V-Kit. Loves it. I've had other people buy them. Haven't had maybe as nice things to say about them. So it's all over the map, and it's how you use them.
if he's got control over them like he has with independent outs, and he can use, you know, EQ them and mix them just like a regular drum set, I'm all for that. Taking the stereo out of a drum brain and putting it into the front of the house, that ain't going to work. And then you have to deal with the drummer who's like moaning and groaning all the time that he's got to play rubber pads. Yeah. But yeah, there's ways of whipping them into shape. I would also say about drums, if you've got a smaller room especially, that you might want to try a studio kit rather than a rock and roll kit. Instead of big 26-inch kick drums and huge floor tom-toms, go for more of a studio-size kit or a cocktail kit, like an 18 or a 20-inch kick with small racks and a little floor. They're made for tone more than projection. So when you're in a studio, you mic those things up and they have a beautiful sound to them. But they're not necessarily made to project to an arena, you know. I see Neil Peart drum kits in like Holiday Inn conference rooms. It's crazy. That was the nursery. So it wasn't even the real deal. You can do shields. We talked about drum shields and the proper design of those. I won't spend a lot of time on that right now, but there are bad design drum shields and there are good ones. And if you want to know more about that, you can talk offline to me about that. These things are very helpful. They replace the guitar amp. This thing. They emulate speaker cabinets. They're not guitar effects. So the guitar player is always complaining because he wants the sound of his guitar amp. You can't take an electric guitar and put a direct box on it. And you can't put it into a pedal board and take it out from that because it doesn't sound like it's going through a speaker. These things emulate speakers. Different type of speakers. Vox AC30s, Fender Blackfaces, you know, you name it. High Watts, Marshalls. Lincoln Brewster swears by these things. I've been in his church, swore that he was playing through a stack of Marshalls, only to find out it was a Line 6. And even on his records, he doesn't use amplifiers. This is what he uses. The guy's also an unbelievable engineer. He knows how to tweak things. And he works with things. He not only plays and sings on his own records, he engineers them all. And when he's running sound for his band, he's on a wireless guitar. He'll come up by front of house, and he'll be playing with his band on his wireless and helping the engineer to get the right sound. So he's really engaged in the whole process. So if you're going to get a device, it's like anything. Get a new keyboard. Are you going to use it this Sunday before you really had a chance to shed with it? I would advise not to. I did that once. I bought a new Kurzweil keyboard, thought I had it down, had a beautiful meditation patch for when it gets quiet and worshipful, and I accidentally hit the wrong patch button. It was called nuclear apathy. I blew the church up in a really beautiful moment of meditation. So every time I get anything new now, I'm using it for like a month, 2 months. So that thing is forward and backward before I ever use it in service. New processor in your rack. Don't try using a new effect 10 minutes before the service starts. All right? In your monitors. So just pretty much gave you the lowdown about these things. These things are beautiful because unlike a headphone, headphones don't isolate. So you put a headphone on, and you're still going to hear ambient noise coming through them because they're not isolating you away from the sound. They might cut it down a little bit, but not enough where it's going to do much good. You're just going to have to crank the headphone up a lot. We're doing a similar seminar as this up at the Kingdom Bound Festival a few years ago. And they didn't have a closed room. I don't know if anybody's been to Kingdom Bound or not. They hold it at a Six Flag amusement park. And they had us in one of these open, like, picnic pavilions, you know, with the open sides, and there's all picnic tables in it. And we had Avion mixers on every picnic table. And we had earphones enough for about half of the side, and the other half was headphones. And right next to us was Viper, the roller coaster. So I'm speaking like this, you know, and then what about anybody? Ah! All right, just start talking again. Ah! It was crazy. Couldn't hear anything. So I'm wearing in-ear monitors. I'm talking through a wireless. And we noticed that when we were doing the demonstration, after we were packing up everything, everybody with the headphones had the volume on the Avion mixers all the way up. And the half with the in-earphones was at about a little past half. That's how much they isolated versus this. to get them away from the roller coaster noise. That was a very telling example for me, the difference between the two. The other thing is, you know, no woman on a platform is going to want to wear headphones. She might do her hair like Princess Leia, but she doesn't want the headphones to make her look like that. And then the other thing about it, from the congregation standpoint, if you see people with the headphones on the stage, don't you kind of feel like they're like disassociated with everything? They're like, what are they listening to, like the World Series or something? They're like not connected. So these things disappear on your head. If you're wearing them properly, put them behind your ear, down your back, a lot of people won't even know you have them on. So that's what I like about earphones. Now, here's where we get into the weaknesses of them, okay? If you're going to use an ear monitor and you don't have control of your own mix, that's a very frightening thing for some people. He's got control of my mix. He's going to turn that thing up, and I'm going to go deaf. It's just a fear factor. You know, in some cases, it's true. Because if you're used to mixing wedges and you're going to mix ears like that, you're going to make too drastic a move for an in-ear monitor. In-ear monitors have to be subtle. Little tiny gradations are a lot in an in-ear monitor. It goes a long, long way, just this much. So the sound person has to learn how to do some of those kind of things. So if you're going to adopt in-ear monitors, it's like the keyboard story or like the Line 6 thing. I would suggest rehearsing with those things for a month, 2 months before you ever use them on stage. Because another reason is if you've got somebody who's got a bad experience with an in-ear monitor right off the bat, you're never going to get them back. So you want to be as helpful and encouraging and make it as great an experience as you can for them to adopt them. And I've seen churches that just force people to wear them. I've even seen it at concerts. You know, they don't have wedges, so you're going to have to wear an in-ear monitor. The person's never worn them in their life. And now they're like, how'd you feel as a performer, as an artist, not being able to hear yourself or hear yourself too much or I'm not used to these things or falling out of my head? So there's a lot of things you have to get used to. In-ear monitors sound better with a stereo mix. And a lot of consoles don't have stereo auxes. So you're usually going to get a monophonic send, which is not as good. You might have to buy a monitor board. Where are you going to find a monitor engineer, though? So this whole thing now of technology has been to, because we don't have monitor engineers and the luxury of a monitor console, everything's being run from front of house and the musicians are not getting what they need because of the distance and I can't hear what you're hearing. We're going to give more of the control back to the musician and these things now that are called personal monitor mixers. And a lot of companies make them. Hearback makes an 8-channel one. Avion makes a 16-channel one. And this new company, Momentum, makes a 32-channel one. So has anybody ever seen an Avion mixer before? Okay. So you see the little 16 buttons, and you have a volume control, and you have a global bass and treble, and then you can store those settings. You can have 16 scenes. You can recall them, and it's really cool, and it sounds great. And it's all digital, and there's no latency. There's no delay in the sound at all. Well, this is just an innovation after the fact. This is a wireless mixer. And instead of having a mixer for each musician, this thing can be passed around to every musician and can access one of 8 mixes for each person. And it controls the boxes remotely, wirelessly. It looks like a little Game Boy, so Crowder carries it around in his pocket. He wants to adjust his mix, he takes it out. People in the concert are going, why is he playing with his Game Boy? But that's what the Momentum mixer looks like. It's called the Tweak. Each performer can tweak their own custom stereo mix. So you as a front-of-house engineer, if you've got the front-of-house mix done and now you're going to concentrate on the monitors, that's going to take the longest amount of time, typically, because depending on how big your team is, each member of that team is going to want the monitor mix a certain way, right? That takes a lot of time. What if you didn't have to do that anymore? I never had to do monitors again. How much is that worth? I wish we sold Momentum. Because you're right, it takes up a lot of time, and let the musicians do it themselves. Yeah.
I actually have the blessing of being under the mentor. One of my mentors is a guy that did the Harvest Fest. He used to do the sounds of Harvest Fest. And one of the things that we've been talking about is, and I don't know, maybe you can clarify this for me, is that right now we use these cheap little resistor type, wireless in-ear monitors. And, I'm constantly being told that there's no way to get stereo in for a wireless in-ear.
All the in-ear monitors that I know of that are made that are wireless are all stereo. Sennheiser, Shure, Audio-Technica.
Which is the model that we're using?
Yeah, and usually
using a Listen.
You might be talking about the aux and...
I think they're probably using a Listen, maybe.
Maybe a Listen, okay.
That's like for
hearing assisted listening. Yeah. Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah, because they're more cost-effective.
Yeah, I mean, $300 for...
Right.
Yeah, for a bunch of them. I think that's what they're using, and they are all mono.
Okay. But even with stereo systems, I mean, a lot of times it's the problem with the board. You don't have a stereo send,
right.
So that's what's
I know that's what we do have. That's what I was kind of always arguing. It's like,
right.
Why can't we do this?
Now, these things can run some money, obviously, but there's some do-it-yourself things that you can do to get the same result. I mentioned that I was a keyboard player, and I have used in-ear monitors from time to time. And when I do that, I got my keyboards plugged into a mixer, my vocal mic, and I take a band mix and put it into a channel or two channels. I put my earphones or headphones right into that. That's my Avion mixer. I had the mixer anyway. I'm just putting a channel of monitor mix into the mixer, and I've got that in relation to everything else that I'm going to use. Drummers can do the same thing. I think the V-drum's brain has a line in to it, so you can take an aux send right into the brain of the V-drums. If not, I've seen drummers who actually have their own mics, put them into their mixer. They'll take a direct split off the bass guitar and put that into a channel. They love to hear bass, right? Bass guitars like to hear drums, vice versa. Now, that's their Avion system. They're controlling their mix. It works better if you use what's called a splitter. So you got one microphone, you split it to front of house, and you split it to them, so everybody has their own control. Rather than give the front of house a mix of the drummer's mixer, that doesn't work as well. So you probably want to split those. And they're isolated transformer split boxes. Your microphone goes in one, has two outputs. And you can get them in one, two, three, four, as many channels as you need. It's also used for recording. So if you want to do a multi-track recording of your service or something, it's best to have it split so you're not just dependent on the front of house for his levels.
Question.
Yeah.
Just real quick, what you're talking about right here, the personal monitor mixing system, that's to give the musician a little more control of their monitors.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
All control.
Yeah. Now, with limitations. The thing I like about the Momentum versus the Avion has a bass and treble control for everything, not individual, for the global. So once you get your mix, you can turn up the bass for the whole mix, you can turn the treble down for the whole mix. It's 16 channels, which is more than enough for most churches. Momentum is 32 channels with 3-band EQ on each channel. So each individual instrument can be tweaked to your heart's desire. So it all depends on what kind of control you're looking for. For a background vocalist, she just wants to hear more of herself. So
the profile system we have in the other room, that the board over there, they have another add-on to theirs. It's kind of like the Momentum system. But it works with their boards, that their board actually, the front of house guy can have total override of all the things on stage, and or if they're having a problem getting the mix that they want, he can help them get the mix from front of house too, which is a kind of a different way of looking at it too.
Okay, let's get into some of the other stuff, the advantage of in-ear monitoring, apart from all this Momentum sales stuff.
How has Momentum been out?
Well, it's Proco. I mean, Proco's been around forever, but this is their digital stuff. It started out as a formation of a digital snake. So you have a digital snake, which is 256 channel capability. Saddleback just put a Momentum snake in. They didn't even buy the tweaks yet. They just bought the snake because they're using Avioms with a Momentum snake. But I would imagine eventually they'll probably go for the boxes, the little tweaks. So you've got all this sound coming out of a monophonic wedge. So if I want to make something louder, I've got to, or more identifiable, I've got to use volume as a way to make it stand out, right? Because I can't spread things out with a mono wedge. So the advantage of stereo mixing is I can place things in a field. I have an electric guitar and a mono wedge and an acoustic guitar and another electric guitar and keyboards all come out of a wedge. What's going to be identified is the loudest thing in that mix. With this, I can put electric guitar here, acoustic here, vocals, acoustic guitar, electric guitar, keyboards, dead center. You get the idea? Right. Right, or a penny whistle. And then every mix can be custom. So just because this person's hearing it this way doesn't mean this one has to. Again, it's a facility of your board. If you only have two auxiliaries to do two monitor mixes, what are you going to do? You have a band mix and a vocal mix. Everybody's going to have to compromise somewhere along the line. So the more auxes you have, the better off you're going to be. This alleviates the need for a new board because you're giving every musician their own little mixer. You follow me? Now, the other way to go is like a profile, or in this little box, I've got a Yamaha LS9. You could do all pre-programmed mixes in a digital board, too, without the need of some of these. So if you know somebody's going to use essentially the same kind of mix week to week, you just come into church and you hit recall, and there's that mix again, all set. So you got to have some direction of where you want to go with your gear down the road. Where do you want to be in a year, 2 years, 5 years? What's your long-term plan? You know, is one thing going to suffice for everything that I want to do? Do I need these components? So it's going to take some homework and some thought to figure out really it is what you want to do. But in any case, earphones should be used. Yeah.
How easy is it to use, like, would it be feasible to adjust the mix through that momentum that you were talking about from song to song, like if a singer is like, I'm having trouble following, you know, the...
Right. Yeah, with the tweak, it would be. But let me tell you about something else that just came out that's working with momentum that just blew me away at a worship conference I did in Dallas. There's a company called Corvallis that makes a digital screen called Same Page. And it displays all of your music and your charts to the whole worship team. Okay? So the director of music can take a thumb drive and put it in his and network to all the people. And now they all have the list for the day. He can notate on the screen, modulate here, we're only going to do the chorus twice, tag, we're out. Okay, and go right to this song. Now, that's one cool part of it. You don't need music or charts anymore. The other cool part of it ties into momentum. There's a tab on it that says mix, and the 32 channels of your momentum come up on the screen, and it's all touch screen. And you just flip the faders up, EQ it to your heart's desire, and store it for that song. The next song, do that for that song. Take your thumb drive, put it in, and save it. It's ridiculous. That music stand just became a mixer and a music stand.
Well, might as well just go home.
Yeah.
Well, they have the band in the box, too. No, I'm just kidding.
Now, it's pricey, but that's where it's going. Conversion. Everything's coming together. Convergence. Everything's coming together, so it's not difficult, you know, to take this thing out. And, oh, my, not right in the middle of that. It's too loud. You know, holding your Game Boy and you're trying to play guitar, it's a little precarious. But even if it was a wired mixer, it would be precarious to try to change your mix during the song. You want to get a lot of that stuff, even if you're the front of house guy. Do you really want to be adjusting lots of levels and EQ while the service is going on? Hopefully a lot of that stuff has been taken care of beforehand, and the sound guy is looking up at the platform the whole time, not his head buried down here. That is the most annoying thing to me as a worship leader, if he's not looking up. You imagine playing piano. You're holding it together. There's no drummer, no bass player. You got to do everything, and you're singing, right? Where do you get time to lift your hand up to go, right? Sustain pedal, right? Okay, let's continue here. We don't need to go through the snake stuff, do we?
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
You said that the whole wireless touchscreen monitor mixer thing, you said pricey. What exactly is pricey?
Well, look at like a. Let's start with the bottom line. Hearback. That's a good system if you don't need a lot of channels, and it doesn't have any recall or saving of scenes in it per se. But it's all digital. It sounds good. a little module about this big, goes on a mic stand, and you have control over 6 channels and 1 stereo mix. Okay? And you can get about 4 mixers in the converter, which would convert your analog signals from the board into digital, which would transmit that down a Cat5 cable, which is the premise of all of them, really, to this little hearback thing. And you can get 4 mixers in the converter and the cables for probably around, what, $1,000, $1,200, a little more?
Maybe $15,000 to $2,000.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think it's $2,000. I think it's a lot less than that. But the limitations are such that when you go to the next step, which is Avium, now you're getting twice as many channels, and you're getting all the recall capability. You can mute, you can solo groups, you can save scenes, and that's about twice as much. So you're looking at...
Running around for about a system of like 5 units or something, it's probably run around $4,000 or $4,500.
Right. So then you get to the Momentum stuff, and it's going to be higher yet.
At least double that again, probably.
I don't think it's double. It depends on the configuration, the kind of box you're going to use. Right.
There's a lot of different. How do you get it?
Yeah, but it's not twice as much. I don't even know if it's like 1 times as much, but it's more money, put it that way.
What about the Corvallis?
The what?
The Corvallis.
Oh, the Corvallis? Yeah, I don't know what the price of that is.
They do an ROI based on how much return on investment, based on how much paper you're burning, toner and all that kind of stuff. And they say, you know, it's 2 to 3 years for most people to pay off.
Right.
This is really big.
They're coming out in different configurations, I heard, but I only saw the one you're talking about, which it's not as big as this, obviously.
It's 2 8.5 by 11 sheets plus a little bezel.
Right. And but when they added this mixer component, I just went, ooh, okay, now that's something to think about. Because it's per song. It's not whatever. All right, so let's talk about the isolation again. When somebody puts earphones on, they are going to feel terribly isolated. So everybody stick your fingers in your ears for a minute. It's not that good, but, you know, you get the point. So I worked with Chris Tomlin years ago when he was just playing colleges for like $1,000 a night, and he was wearing in-ears back then and running the levels up to red and pulling them out of his ear. And so we had a little consultation with him and his sound guy, and it took a while. It took about 5 months before he actually got them dialed in to where he loved them and never pulls them out again. It took EQing, a little processing, getting the right levels. But if anybody's seen Tomlin, I know he's the kind of worship leader who likes to hear the congregation sing more than he likes to hear himself sing. So he's always backing off from the mic and letting the congregation sing. How great is our God? Holy, holy, holy. He loves all that stuff. He couldn't hear it because he was isolated. So the only way to fix it is to set some mics up that are behind the main stacks aimed at the congregation. And you bleed these mics into their in-ear monitor to bring the room back into their mix. These do not go into the PA. People will be ripping their ears out faster than you can say hallelujah. But the point of this is to get a nice image of the room from where you'd be standing. Now, this is a compromise for everybody on the stage. I mean, the ideal thing would be to have something in front of you that would be like a 1-point stereo mic that would be from your exact location. That would be ideal, but that's a little much for everybody to share their own stereo mic and their own mix. So we make a compromise like this. When you're running these into their mix, make sure that these are properly oriented. That the left mic is facing the left side of the stage, it's coming out of your left ear, and the right mic is there, coming in your right ear. Because if the man in the yellow shirt stands up and yells hallelujah and it comes out of this ear, I'm totally screwed up. So you get proper orientation. You do not want to use your choir mics for these because you'll have out-of-body experiences. You really will literally feel like you're floating because of the position of the microphone. I'm not kidding. Go to some of the Disney animation rides and stuff. They're all playing with psychoacoustics to make you think the sound is coming from somewhere based on those kind of placements, and that's how they do it. Now, the problem with this positioning is it's fine when I'm facing the congregation, but the bass player on my left, as soon as I turn around now, is coming out of my left ear, and he's over there. So the next generation of in-ear monitors, which are already here, One company, Sensophonics, and the other one is Westone, I think.
They stopped it.
Yeah, they couldn't get it right. The Sensophonics are unbelievable, and I guess they just saw the writing on the wall. Sensophonics, by the way, in case somebody doesn't know that company, is owned by a guy named Michael Santucci. He's an audiologist. He's the preeminent audiologist for performers in the country, and he has his own in-ear company. He makes molds for everybody's earphones, or he makes his own, which are custom drivers. Chris Tomlin wears them, Dave Matthews Band, Riverdance, Elton John. He's got some great clients. But he's all about hearing health. He wants to preserve your hearing. He speaks all over the country at medical conferences and stuff about hearing loss. So if you want to go to a great site about hearing and hearing loss and the damage it can be done by not taking care of yours, go to Sensophonics, Sensaphonics. Hooked on phonics, hooked on Sensophonics. Anyway, he's got this thing now that the microphones are built right into the ear monitor. The ambient mics are miniature microphones right in the same place where your monitors are. So you're always perfectly oriented. I'm talking to you before I go on stage, and you have to take them out. There's a little talk switch. So I'm talking to you. I go on stage, and I set it for performance level, and it, like, ducks them down and stuff. He's even working on a new scheme that'll be like a ducker. So as the congregation is quiet during performance, as the band quiets down, the ducker will allow the congregation to come up automatically with thresholds that you set. It's crazy. And no matter where you turn, you're always properly oriented. Those are pricey. We're actually talking to him, I think, just between us.
We hope.
How we can make something like that more affordable for the church. And he works very closely with Schur. And Michael Santucci, Santucci. This is another way to do the same stereo spread, but a little bit more phase coherent. You would use what's called an XY or a near coincident. You take two of the same exact kind of microphones and you put them so that they're almost touching each other. And you can angle them from 90 to about 130 degrees. We talked about phase before. When you have this mic and this mic spread out like this, this mic's going to be focused here, but it's still going to get some sound from this side eventually and be a little bit out of phase with this one. So when you put them right here in the same point in space, all the sound kind of arrives at one point in space at the same time. That's the point of it.
Yeah. Would that be a good technique to use if you have... house speakers that are like on stage, portable, like a portable system, instead of having on the side pointing in, have it in the middle pointing.
For your loudspeakers?
Yeah.
No. Well, it depends where those speakers are. I mean, if you're talking about a cluster that's in the center and named that way, that might be a good thing. But from the stage in front of everybody, that probably wouldn't be good. Right, Dave?
Well, it depends on what you're looking to do.
Right.
Well, if you put them in the center like that, you have a band that's as wide as the stage. And all of a sudden, they all sound like they're squished up coming out of this thing here. It's really good. They usually do those center clusters for speech only. So when the guy's standing in the center of the stage talking, it actually sounds like he's coming from there rather than omnipresent, per se. But when it comes to the bands and stuff like that, it kind of gets a little weird because you're having a stage wash come off
right
here, and then there's just the louder part comes out here.
Mm-hmm. So for a portable house, it's still better to separate them.
Yeah, I think
I think so. Dave Matthews Band has the slickest setup I've ever seen. You ever heard about that? Everybody's wearing a lavalier mic. And they're a jam band. So they're not really playing to a list, per se. I mean, they might play one song for 15 minutes. So how do you communicate with your band if you're a jam band? You're not really following a certain song structure, right? So everybody in the band's got a lavalier on. They got a series of foot switches. And Dave Matthews has a switch that is all band. Monitor engineer, front of house, or any of the individuals in the band. Not how he keeps track of all that, but it's all right there. All the other guys have lavaliers on, and they have foot switches, but not as numerous as him. So if you see Dave Matthews, if you ever go to see him, he's singing like this, and he's back away, and he's still moving his lips. People wonder what he's doing, you know. He's saying, all right, guys, we're going to play this chorus one more time. then we're going to switch. We're going to not do that song. We're going to do this song. He's talking to everybody in the band. And everybody's right on track with him. It's a beautiful thing if you're a worship team and the Holy Spirit hits, throw the list away. Or unless you're doing this stuff, you know. But discrete communication is one of the biggest advantages of in-ear monitors. You wouldn't be able to do any of that stuff with a wedge. Pastor gets on my earphone and says, you're like 20 minutes past the time you're supposed to be done. This is the last song. So, okay. Last song, guys.
That works well with a lot of time in that situation. Also.
Right.
Music to start a sermon at the right time.
I do that all the time because I don't have a band in my little church. I have a motif, so I'm using loops a lot. And I play along with this iWorship DVD because it's synced to the screen. So I get a click track, right? But sometimes I'll have the whole track playing in here, and I have the track into my mixer. So I'll be playing along, just me and the track is in the earphone, but nobody's hearing it in the house. I hear it in my earphone. I'm playing along. The chorus comes in. I got a volume pedal on the DVD output, so I can bring in the orchestra right at the right time. Everybody goes, how do you do that? So there's some cool things you can do with ear monitors that you can't do with a wedge. Right? Clicks, loops, those are kind of cool too. Drummers are using a lot more click track because we can't find any drummers at playing time anymore. Okay.
Just a couple slides back to the past world.
The ambient mics?
Yeah,
it was probably a sales pitch for Shure mics. This one? I wanted to skip by that one. Yeah, well, what you want to use for ambient mics, and I'll even say for choir mics or for overhead mics, you want to use instrument mics. You don't want to use a vocal mic. You would think for a choir you want to use a vocal mic, but why wouldn't you want to use a vocal mic for a choir? We didn't talk about this yesterday because it wasn't a mic class. But directional microphones have a thing called proximity effect. As you get closer to them, you get more bottom end, more bass response. And all vocal mics roll off the low end because they know you're going to use them close. So if you put a vocal mic 2 to 3, 4 feet away from a choir, it's going to sound as thin as you can imagine. Instrument mics, on the other hand, are flat out 20 to 20. So even from a distance, they're going to get all the low end you want. You're going to want to tailor them and maybe roll off some of the junk and things like that. But the same thing with ambient mics. You want to use that instrument mic for miking your congregation for ambient sound. And then again, you're going to want to roll off 350, 400, because of that murmur of the congregation is going to muddy things up. You just want some of the detail. Yeah?
Just like I said, you mentioned mics. If you were going to mic a choir, which mic would you say?
Well, these are all good choices right here. I've got them good, better, and best. These all sound very nice on a choir. I mean, my favorites are these. You wouldn't need this one. These are exactly the same microphone. The only difference is that this has a little collar on it that turns it into an omnidirectional microphone. So you could use that for recording if you had a need, but otherwise you're going to use directional mics for your choir, which is what this one is. It's cardioid only. The SM-81 has been a classic, but it's a little long in the tooth. These are actually less expensive and sound better, in my opinion, than that one. These will also fit into a lot more applications. I can do an X, Y, and a piano with these with a half stick. They're shorter. Okay, that's enough for the Shure stuff. Get back to the butt kicker. Christian company, believe it or not. They're going to call it the A-kicker, but they're a Christian company. And what do these things do? Anybody know?
Low end.
Yeah, they kick your butt. That's what they do. They're low end. He's exactly right. They're tactile transducers. They will shake something. They'll move. When a low frequency goes through them, they vibrate. And they originally came out for home theater applications. People would strap these to their couches and watch Star Wars and... They make them for their chairs. They have a gamer butt kicker that goes on your computer chair. But they're making them for performance now. They got their claim to fame was when Shania Twain went on tour. They had, I think, something like 26 of these on the stage. No wedges on the stage. We were talking about before mixing your mains before monitors. One of the reasons is you get the energy from the room. When you go completely wedgeless, there's nothing there to move you. You might hear the detail, but bass players like to feel their pant leg move. And drummers like to feel the thump on the riser when they're kicking the kick drum. So if there's no wedges there and you're playing electronic drums, you're just getting all this through your inner. That's not going to make your pant leg move. So they have a couple of different designs. They have this kind here, which would actually strap to a drum throne or a keyboard chair. Then they have the kind that like a bass player would be able to stand on. And what you'll do with these things, you'll just put the low frequency content material to the amplifier that drives this. You don't want to run these full range. You want to cross them over and limit their frequency to maybe what?
Probably
200, 150?
Yeah, I was going to say 100 down.
Probably. Yeah. So what they'll do when you get that kind of content, they'll only shake when it feels those frequencies. So now if the bass player and the drummer are removed, it doesn't matter. These things are as fast as sound. He hits that, and the bass player immediately feels the kick drum.
It's actually faster than sound.
Yeah, speed of light, actually. Mm-hmm. So if that bass player can't play in time with a butt kicker, time to look for a new bass player.
All right, we just got the bass player one, like Monday.
Yeah.
With the platform deal, would you say, obviously tie him into it, but would you also tie the kick drum to him? Would that help? Is that good?
Yeah. I treat the bass guitar and the kick drum as one instrument. If they're not playing as one instrument, that's a problem. And there's not too many things you can do to fix it. You can side chain with a compressor and stuff like that, but it's not the same as having a bass player who's playing in time. And if he can't feel the time, it's one thing to not hear the time. If you can't feel that, the kick just went boom, and you didn't come in on time. What's up with that? But that's what they do. They shake. Here's another cool device you can get with in-ear stuff, and it doesn't even require a separate lavalier mic like Dave Matthews has. You can use your standard vocal mic. This has got different names, different companies call it different things. One company, like Proko, calls it a panic button. Other companies call it a cough drop. Basically what it is, you put your microphone into the box, okay? And it's got two outputs, and one would go to the mains and one would go to the monitors. Basically, when you're singing to the mains, you step on it, it mutes the mains, and it comes out your monitors. So now you can use the same microphone to talk to your band as long as your foot's on the switch.
Okay, what's that called?
It's called a panic button. Okay, I'm going to just give you a little spiel about wireless stuff. Whether it's a microphone or whether it's an in-ear monitor, don't go wireless if you don't need to.
Yes.
Okay. We can get into a whole FCC white space issue thing, but that's not the time for this. The only reason I'm saying is just from a reliability standpoint and from a need standpoint. I'm a keyboard player. What do I need a wireless microphone for? I'm in one place. I'm a lethargic bass player. I never move. Okay? So why do I need a wireless mic? Give the wireless to the guy who's moving around. Mobility is one reason. So if you're going to give somebody a wireless mic for mobility, why are they standing in front of a wedge? I've got a wireless mic so I can move, but as soon as I move, I don't have any monitor anymore. I'm out of the sweet spot. So if you're going to make somebody wireless, make them completely wireless. Make them wireless mic, wireless in-ears, so they can do a Stephen Curtis Chapman deal. You know, he's got more body packs on him than like a Mexican bandito. You know, like, got the head-worn mic, and he's got his guitar pack, and he's got his in-ear pack. Batteries, like he must have stocks in battery companies or something. And the way wireless in-ears work versus a wireless mic, this is a transmitter here. So you can only transmit on one channel. As a receiver picks it up, it's on its own channel. Well, the kind of opposite is true, not the transmitter part, but because that's a receiver receiving this microphone, this is the transmitter here. This is transmitting your mixes to these packs. You can have as many receivers as you want on a channel. You just can't have more than one transmitter on that channel. That makes sense?
Or more than one mix.
Yeah. This is Kiss FM, and everybody's tuned in to Kiss FM. That's basically the analogy, the illustration. Okay?
But you have to have the same mix on each.
Yeah. Now, the nice thing about these, I was saying, all the in-ear monitor systems that I know of that are worth their weight, Sennheiser, Audio-Technica, sure, they're all stereo. But they can be used in two ways. They can be used to receive a stereo mix if you have the luxury of having a stereo auxiliary send. That's a great way to listen. So everybody listening to stereo. Or if you only have mono mixes, you can feed this two mono mixes. You can have a band mix and a vocal mix. And then instead of this being a balance control, it becomes a pan. Pan it to one side, it's the band mix in both ears. It's not just in one ear. So band mix, pan it to the other side, it's the vocal mix in both ears. So with one transmitter, I can do two mixes and then buy the appropriate number of packs. And then if you want to get some mostly vocal mix but bleed a little band in, then just adjust this. It basically becomes a choice of the two mixes as a volume level.
If you have a stereo set of ears, wouldn't you lose one of the in ears when you pan that?
No, not in that mode. It's called a mixed mono mode. You're actually panning between two monophonic mixes. So when you go from one to the other, you're going to start hearing some of the other mix, but it's always in both ears. But it's mono. You don't have the ability to separate things like you do in a stereo mix.
You have both?
Yep, you've got both right in the middle. Yep. So that's how that works. So who wins? The front of house engineer. Sound is controllable, comfortable, focused. Musicians' needs are met. Attention be given to the real job at hand, mixing front of house. Musicians' hearing is protected. They get mix they need. They play tighter. They sing more in tune. And the congregation's sound is more comfortable, cleaner. They can hear without being blown out the back of the church. And these are some guys that helped me prepare that. So anyway, any questions?
Question.
Yep.
In the beginning, you were talking about focusing on the house and then going to the ledges.
Right.
If you're totally in here, that doesn't really apply.
Right. Doesn't apply. Because you're just going to spend time doing the house now anyway. You got your whole band's on in-ears. And if they have their own mixers, they never have to bother you again. Still like to pray with you and eat with you once in a while, but other than that, we don't have to see much of each other. Team building. What's that?
I got a question back here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Our church is, we don't have a building yet. We're using wedges. At this point, which do you think would be more important, getting in-ear monitors or going wireless? Wireless monitors.
Wireless monitors? Or wireless microphones?
Wireless mics.
Depends what your needs are. I mean, wireless microphones to me are like a lower thing on my priority list. If I can do it with wire, I'm going to do it with wire every time. Just because I don't want to deal with the headaches of checking batteries, making sure the antennas are right, coordinating frequencies. There's a lot to do with wireless. And if you really need wireless, then go for it. But you got to be aware of all the stuff that you're going to do. Ever seen a group called Blue Man Group? They got all this wild percussive stuff that they play. And you can't see wires anywhere. They dress them very nicely. But every mic on that stage is wired. Even when you don't think it could be wired.
Yes.
Wired. Wired. Because they're in Vegas most of the time, which is an RF nightmare. So they don't want to be dealing with dropouts and anything like that during like a show that costs somebody $200 to get into. So, yeah. Yeah. Right. And it's all wired. Every mic is wired on that stage. Anyway, that would be my answer to your question. I would get something that you really need. I think that in-ear monitors are going to lower your stage volumes considerably. So that would be more important to me than a wireless mic. Yep.
Your wireless mic may not work in a
right.
year or two.
Well, I'm not going to go that far. Things are really looking a lot more optimistic than they were a year ago. And because of all the things that the churches and sound companies and sportscasters have been helping Shure to fight the FCC with, it's really starting to have an impact. What's that?
What's going on in the future?
It's called the white space issue. 2009, everything becomes digital for television. So up until now, wireless mics and TV stations have been the only things in that band, UHF. So if you're in New York and you have Channel 2, you have wireless mics on Channel 3 because nothing was there. Channel 4, there'd be a TV station, and we'd be on Channel 5. So you had a very nice coexistence, and there was lots of space. But the FCC got this bright idea, as the world is doing now, of converging to converting to digital, which can really free up a lot of the space. In the old days, you needed a guard station between the analog TV stations because they're not very exact, and they would drift. So you need that 6 megahertz band in between to protect the other TV station. With digital, they're very exact and precise, so you can butt them up right next to each other. which leaves, you know, more room for other things that we can use for. For instance, after 9/11, they needed better communications for first responders. So channels 14 to 20 in the UHF band are now public safety in certain cities. So we don't have those for UHF anymore, so that's been dropped out. So if you have any frequencies, wireless, it's in those frequencies, and you live in Boston, let's say, or Washington, you can't use them anymore. Wireless mics might be in those frequencies. You might have some wireless mics because wireless mics use TV frequencies to transmit. So the first thing you want to do when you're coordinating your microphones is find out what TV stations you're in and stay away from those. But now you're going to have to stay away from some other things. As I'm pointing out, public safety, not in every city, but in major metros, that's that end. In the 700 band, which is 698 megahertz to 806, which is basically TV stations 52 to 69, that's been auctioned off. That's called the 700 band. AT&T, Verizon, some other companies. Why do phone companies want UHF, would you think, where this frequency is? What happens to your cell phone when you walk into Walmart? Dies. Because those cell phone frequencies can't penetrate solid walls or steel. UHF can. And you need less towers. It's a stronger, more robust signal, which is why they want it. So they're willing to pay billions and billions of dollars to get it. Now, that's the auction space, which is now going to leave UHF stations. It used to be 14 to 69. We'll now have 21 to 52, right? That's what we have left, which is still fine, except we were fighting a consortium of manufacturers, Google, Microsoft, Motorola, who want to share that space that's left with wireless mics and TVs, these kinds of things, or community-wide broadband. So if you think you had some problems with wireless before, if these things are allowed to penetrate our neighborhood, it's going to be real difficult. So SHURE has been spending millions of dollars the last 5 years fighting this, gathering up ground support, grassroots support from churches, the theaters in Broadway. Broadway would be out of business. Just in Times Square, there's 1,000 channels of wireless just in one block. The Super Bowl had over 1,000 channels of wireless at the last Super Bowl event. So, but you're fighting billions and billions of dollars who see this as real estate. And you know what? Microsoft just bent their knee. When the church supports are coming, SHURE asked me to get as many mega churches to sign a petition for the FCC as I could get. And up until then, they had all the sports groups, NBA, PGA, Major League Baseball, they all signed on. All the theaters, New York, L.A., they all signed on. Church, they waited for last. And when the FCC and Microsoft saw the church, I don't think they wanted to touch it. It would be too much of a political... Because up until then, they were considering any wireless microphone user, wherever you were at, church or a theater or whatever, as an illegal immigrant. You never had a license for this, you don't deserve protection. You don't deserve any more protection than we do if we want to use our things in that space. But they have the money to wave at it. I mean, just Microsoft is probably like 50 times larger than the entire audio industry. So there's no way that we'd be able to fight it legally or with money. So that's what that's all about. And I think we're out of time. So wrap it up.
You've been listening to a seminar by Doug Gold, which was given at our Worship God 2008 conference. It has been made available to you through Sovereign Grace Ministries. Sovereign Grace is primarily devoted to planting and caring for churches. We also hold conferences, train leaders, and publish books, music, and audio and video messages. For more information, visit www.sovereigngraceministries.org or call us at 301-330-7400.